Thank you, Shai. I'll talk about CSR. In particular, Shai has asked me to talk about not quite starting the company, but what we did once we started and the sort of things that we thought were important. Just to remind you, CSR is a company that started in Cambridge 5 years before it floated on the London Stock Exchange. Started in April 99, and we raised a total of $85 million before we floated. We've now floated, and we're a company on the London Stock Exchange with a market cap of about £1 billion, round about, and turnover of about $600-700 million per year. And in fact, there were 9 founders of CSR, and indeed none of us at that time had actually started a company. We had worked in small companies, and indeed had worked in large companies, but we hadn't actually started a company until then. So starting a business, art or science, I think the thing to bear in mind when you're starting a company is that it isn't deterministic. Many things will go right, but on the other hand, many things will go wrong. One key, very, very important thing that I'll come to a little later is the business plan. And that isn't just the business plan that you start with in order to raise the money, but it's actually the business plan that you carry through with and helps you run the company as you proceed. I'll come back to that. Isabel will talk about intellectual property. Actually, that's one of the questions that comes up most often when people come to investors with plans. The question is, who owns the intellectual property, or indeed, is there any protectable intellectual property? If there isn't, it's a little more difficult making a success. It's still possible, and the market goes to the swift. Those who get out with the product first into the market are often the winners. But if you can protect your intellectual property, that makes a big difference, of course. I won't dwell on this slide. There's just one word on the second bullet, implementation, and two words, execution. Those are probably the most important words you have to bear in mind as you're running your company. Because not only do you develop your business plan, do you raise your money, but you then have to execute according to business plan. You have to deliver according to the goals and the milestones that you've set out at the beginning. And this is very, very serious. We could have a whole lecture on setting goals and setting objectives and setting milestones. But of course, you have to set them such that you have a reasonable chance of meeting them. There's nothing that makes investors lose faith more in a company than a company that's set 5 objectives over the first year and a half and hasn't met any of them. Find early customers, very important. Again, you don't have to, but you rarely do have revenue when you start a company. But you have to know how that company will generate funds, will generate money, will sell the product to customers. And if you don't know that, you shouldn't expect anybody to actually fund you. And again, I do see a number of business plans where people say, we've got a good product, or we will have a good product, we've been in the market for it, we'll sell it 2 or 3 years from now, and basically, in effect, we'll hope for the best. And that's not good enough. The business plan, as I say, of course you develop this before you raise your money, and these are the, shuffle them around a bit maybe, but pretty much the things that you have to address. But not only that when you're raising the money, but subsequently when you're actually running the business, the market will develop. Actually, it's very clear to me that although you can predict the market to a certain extent, you can't predict over a period of 2, 3, 4 years how it will evolve. And all you need to do really is to make sure that you're in the right position at the right time to tackle those market opportunities as they evolve, because they're not deterministic and things will change as you go along. What I mean by two, the offering and the ambition, is that you need to offer something. Come back to the business model, whether it's a product or service or the license of intellectual property. And ambition. Do be ambitious. If you're not ambitious, there's no reason why anybody should fund your company. If you expect a lifestyle business, if you are drawing up your business plan, if you're expecting to take full holidays for the first couple of years, nobody will be interested in funding or sticking with you. You have to work very hard. You have to give up a lot to be a successful entrepreneur. I'll come back to the business model. Just a point on the management team. You don't have to have a full management team when you start. You must do a little analysis, see what gaps are missing. You know, are you lacking in finance or marketing or indeed sales? Hopefully, particularly around here, you'll be pretty okay with technology and experience with using technology to create products or services. But nobody expects you to have a full management team when you actually come out with your business plan. And constitution of the board, we can talk about that a little later, but that is very, very important. And the fact that you have a board, particularly you've thought about what your board will look like when you're proposing your business plan, is very important. And really what's most important is you as founders on the board, perhaps larded with a bit of extra skill and experience. But you don't need to put 4 MBEs and 5 professors on the board to impress investors, because that by itself won't impress investors. People you've worked with, perhaps in the university, to do what you want to do, you know, add them by all means, but you don't need to suck the board with the good and the great to start with. Valuation, that again is a lecture, is a talk all by itself, because you will find when you produce your business plan, when you have some idea of revenue, you know, you've probably all seen Dragon's Den. You say you want to raise £500,000, £100,000, maybe £1 million, and the investors will say, okay, what's your company worth? And if you say company's worth £2 million, they give you £1 million because they end up with 50% of the company, and that may be right. But the bottom line on valuation, although you can read books on it, and there are lots of learning papers on it, it's like selling a second-hand car. You need competition, you need lots of people willing to give you money, and then you'll get a good price for it. If there's only one outfit, one VC that you're chasing, he can determine the price, and you don't want that. So if you want to talk about valuation, if you're close to it, let's have a chat. But basically, bottom line is, company's worth what you can get for it. Business model, there are a number of business models. I mentioned products, services, license of intellectual property. The only thing you need to be very, very clear about as you're developing your plan, and in particular as you're running your business, is what is that model? Be clear about it and stick to it, at least until you've shown that it does or it doesn't work. And, you know, again, I've come across a number of companies with business plans that says, we'll sell some consulting, we'll develop a product, and by the way, we'll license the intellectual property. There's no way you can do all three of those things out of a small company initially. You might be able to do two, but you should certainly focus on doing one very well. As I say, we raised $85 million worth of funding, and you did the first round. Round one there was two local companies, Herman Houses Amadeus and 3i. We raised £6 million initially, and if you're going for an angel round, of course, you'll be looking at raising maybe £100,000, maybe £200,000-£300,000. And there is a good number of angels, there are a good number of groups of people who will fund those sort of companies here in Cambridge. So Cambridge is a great place to be to raise money. Rules of the game, I think I've mentioned a few of these. There are actually quite a few lifestyle businesses around, and nobody likes funding lifestyle businesses. If investors fund a company, they want to see the people work very, very hard to make them money and indeed make the investors money. Raising sufficient capital, that's a British disease, unfortunately, is not raising enough money to fund the company through its difficult early days. And we often find that for comparable companies, those in America are often better funded than those in the UK. And that's for a number of reasons. But do make sure, if you can, you match the raising of the capital with the valuation of the company. I mean, the bottom line is, as you proceed, as you get revenue, as you make a name for yourself, the valuation of the company rises. Therefore, as you raise money, as that valuation rises, you give away less of the company. And don't strive for perfection. Again, I see that a lot. Quite often the American approach with products seems to be get out there first. Doesn't matter if the product doesn't work superbly, create the market share and get it right afterwards. I think we tend to polish a little too much here in this country, and of course persevere. Culture of innovation, very important, can-do approach. I'm sure you've all been through this, but you know, try and think, if you have a problem, the answer is yes, how do you solve it, rather than think of the 55 reasons why it is a problem and why you won't be able to achieve what you want to achieve. Strong team, CSI and R had 9 founders. That was maybe, you know, in theory a little too many. Certainly one is too few. Doing this by yourself is very, very lonely. You need 2 or 3 of your shoulders to cry on, people to encourage you. So the answer is between, you know, 1 and 9 maybe. And willingness to bake a big cake, that is, raise sufficient money quickly in order to get to market and be a success. And again, you know, look at your market, your available market. If it's a global market, as indeed most of them are these days, go to the global market. Nobody's interested in funding companies that are just looking at the UK, which indeed at the end of the day is a very, very small market for most products in world terms. And again, these last two, the key words, reliable execution and be very, very focused. There are lots of things you can do, but you know, you have to stop doing a good number of things in order to be focused on the thing that's very important for your company, the business model, and getting that product out there in the marketplace. great thing about Cambridge is that we do have role models. Indeed, we have them at CSR. You know, we were able to look at people we knew in Arm and say, look, those guys started Arm. They made a lot of money for themselves and their shareholders. They're no different to us. If they can do it, we can. And as the years have gone by, we have a lot of very good examples of people who've done that around the Cambridge area. And, you know, that's really what you need. Somebody to not copy, but to say, they're like me, they've done it, therefore I can do it. Business model, very important. I've said all those things, I think, really. Execution, bottom line there is everything. So I'll stop there, and Isabel and I will be very, very pleased to take questions afterwards. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. Well, Phil's talked about the interesting side of being an entrepreneur and running a business. I guess my job here tonight is to be a bit of a boring lawyer and talk about some of the downsides, the responsibilities of running a business. I did notice that on Phil's last slide, one of the things he didn't mention was speak for a lawyer. So I hope by the end of this evening you'll bear that in mind. Because, as I say, my role is a counterweight to make you think about responsibilities. Because when you run a business, there are lots of duties and liabilities that you're quite likely to take on board. And in this respect, I'm talking about things that are other than just pure financial duties and responsibilities. So one of the first things I'd like to do this evening is talk about limited liability. Really, I'd like to debunk the myth of limited liability. Because there's very much a feeling that goes around that, you know, if you and your mate want to set up a limited liability company, if things go wrong, if things go pear-shaped, then you personally don't incur any liability for any of the debts of the company. And if things go wrong, you and your mate can walk off into the sunset whistling a happy tune. Well, that's not the case at all. It's far, if you like, it's the other end of the spectrum. So apart from, let's say, a cowboy builder who's just doing everything in cash, you could perhaps get away with that sort of thing. You are going to incur liabilities in your position as a director, as a person running a business. And this sort of situation has partly arisen because of all the sort of well-known examples of corporate collapse that we've all heard about in the last few years, you know, good old Enron. Okay, Enron happened in the States, but it's cast its shadow over UK law as well. And this year, UK Parliament is bringing into our legislation an act called the Companies Act 2007, which sets out the duties of directors, i.e. what directors must legally do. This is a huge piece of legislation. In fact, it is the largest piece of legislation ever enacted by our Parliament in the UK. So that goes to show how important the government feels regulating what companies can and can't do, what you, when you start a company or run a company, can and can't do is. In fact, one of my colleagues was telling me the other day that apparently if you print out the whole Act together with all the sort of schedules and bits and bobs that go with it, the specific paper, and this is on ordinary A4, ordinary font size, will be over 2 metres high. So I don't suggest you go and do it when you get home, but it just give you a scale. So I'm just going to sort of highlight a few little things this evening. But directors' duties is one of the main focuses of the Act, because what that Act does is bring in a duty on all directors to act in a way that they consider in good faith is to be the most likely to promote the success of the company, having regard to all the interests of the members of that company. So all directors now have to act in good faith, and every time they make a decision, they have to think, is this decision going to promote the best, is this likely to be the best decision to promote the best interests of the company? And the Act in question lays down a list of sort of non-exclusive factors that you as directors are going to have to take into account when you're making decisions. And those factors are things such as, you've got to take into account the interests of your employees. You've got to take into account the need to foster good relationships with suppliers and customers. You've got to take into account the interests of the environment and the community. So obviously as a director, you wouldn't be printing out the relevant Act, because that's not going to help the environment. You've got to take into account the interests of all the members as a whole of the business. There's a huge list of factors that you've got to consider when you're making decisions. We don't yet know in practice what that's going to mean. We're waiting for more guidance as to how you as a director are going to have to do that. But at the very least, it's going to mean when you're making decisions, you're going to have to start documenting the fact that you've ticked the boxes. You thought, I thought about the environment, I thought about the community, I thought about my employees, now I'll go on and make the decision. Because that's the other thing that the Act in question brings into being. It's was described in the House of Lords as introducing a double whammy. This expression the House of Lords don't use very often. But what they meant was, not only does it introduce this whole new concept of liability for directors, it also enables shareholders who think the director hasn't acted in that way, hasn't taken into account the environment when making that decision, they can sue the director personally for that breach of duty. So things are going to get more difficult, in theory anyway. And so as directors in a company, you're going to be really needing to think about issues such as liability. And so, for example, you'd want to ensure, if you're a director of a company, that you have a contract, a director service agreement with that company, so that they would indemnify you and provide insurance in case a shareholder sues you. So it's a sort of piece of paper that at the time when you're setting up a company, and we're all in that position, that you've got all the excitement of the business plan, investors running in and out, but you've got to think of those basic things. The other aspect I wanted to highlight, without sounding too much like a prophet doom all the time, is shareholders' agreements. Now, again, this is something that's often overlooked when people are setting up a company. But what I want to get across is the fact that it's much better to spend your money on getting the agreements in place at the start of the business, at the start of your entrepreneurial career, rather than wasting money on lawyers trying to sort out a mess if things go wrong. And I like to think about shareholders' agreements as being a bit like prenuptial agreements. You need to think about things when you're all happy, when you and your mates are sitting around over a cup of coffee, working out who's doing what in the company, who's going to have what size of share, rather than sorting it out when there's a huge divorce and everyone's going off to their own corner consulting lawyers. Because what a shareholders' agreement is a contract, an agreement between the shareholders that sets out their rights between themselves. So it deals with the number of shares, which is the sort of thing you'd be thinking about anyway. So if you're getting friends and family and angels to put the money into the company, it's very easy to say who's going to have how many shares. But what a shareholders' agreement does is say, ah, yes, we accept how many shares you can have, but what can you do with them? For example, if the business isn't doing too well, and somebody, one of the shareholders, wants to sell their shares, can they do that? Can they sell them to any third party? If you're a small company, you might not want them to sell to any third party. You might want to force them to offer them to the other shareholders first. Equally, if the business is doing well and an investor wants to come in and put more money into the business, and one of the shareholders isn't keen on that investor, can you force them to sell their shares to you if they don't want to carry on? So, as I say, it's another piece of paper, I'm afraid, but it's another one that's going to give you protection in running your business. The last area I want to touch on is IP ownership, which is a subject dear to my heart, and I was very pleased to see the prominence that Phil gave it earlier. I think the problem with IP, intellectual property, is its name, because the word intellectual, it comes slightly off-putting. I don't know, what is it? It's touchy-feeling stuff, I can't get a hold of it. I think that's the wrong way to think about intellectual property. It's really important to think about it as a physical asset in the same way as any other asset you might have, like your car, your house, or other kind of property. And as Phil says, the fundamental question that everyone is going to be looking at who wants to invest in your company is going to be the question of who owns the intellectual property. So it's absolutely vital that that's sorted out right at the very beginning. And it's one of those things that it sounds quite straightforward. Well, hey, I came up with the idea, surely I own it. Well, that's all very well in theory, but for a lot of you in sort of like situations where you might be part student, part business person, part doing a bit of work on the side, you've got to ensure that the ideas that you're going to be using to take your company forward are the ideas that you own and aren't owned by, say, the university or that company that you were doing a bit of work for at the weekend. Because that's where things go terribly wrong. The most important thing to appreciate about intellectual property is that the person who creates the work in question, who comes up with the design of a brochure, who comes up with a new piece of software, comes up with a new chemical formulation, is the person that owns the rights in that intellectual property. Now, what the law says is if an employee comes up with some intellectual property in the course of their employment, if they create the work in the course of their employment, then the law would generally speaking say that the employer automatically owns that intellectual property. You don't actually need anything in writing, but having said that, it's good to get it in writing anyway. But when you're an early stage company, like Phil was saying earlier, you can't afford to have lots of employees. You're going to have to shepherd your resources as tightly as you can. So you often will be tempted to start outsourcing things. So the design of your website, the design of some software that's going to work with your particular application, some laboratory work perhaps to the very students that you are yourself, you'll be giving them some money in years to come, hopefully. It's absolutely vital that if you're going to do that, you get something in writing ensuring that you own the IP, because otherwise they will own the IP unless you've got something in writing to the contrary. And it's not just small startup businesses that make those mistakes. huge multinational businesses do that as well. I once acted for a very well-known sports shoe company that was going to go public, going to be listed on the London Stock Exchange. And the whole thing about the sports shoe was, as you'll know better than I, it was all about the brand of the trainers in question, and it had a little logo on the side, and all those logos are the simplest things in the world, aren't they? And they're nothing exciting. But when the investors were examining the company, doing their due diligence before it floated, they discovered that the logo in question had been designed 20 years ago by a guy in China, and there was no documentation to prove that my client owned that logo. And the whole float was nearly pulled 10 days before it was about to go ahead. And we then spent those 10 days rushing around with, imagine, detective agencies and that sort of thing, private investigators, trying to track down this guy who didn't realise how important he was to the whole huge business. And as you can imagine, my clients ended up having to pay him quite a large sum of money because we were somewhat against the clock, and it was easier to pay than argue. But that's one huge example, but there's lots of smaller examples where that sort of thing has gone wrong. So that's a very sort of quick gamble through some of the issues I think are relevant to starting off with a business. And there's a lot more documentation that a business ideally needs at the beginning. I think Shire has put on the handouts a mention of Launchpad, which is a hopefully user-friendly guide to starting a business that my firm has produced. It's available on the internet, so feel free to log on to our website to access that, because it talks you through the sort of issues that some things that I'm talking about, but also in greater detail, and many others as well, if you want to have a look at that. So, thank you very much. Thank you.
Yes, I think it was manager and technical. I mean, we spun out of a local company, Cambridge Consultants, and we are all engineers. But some of the ones with grey hairs and maybe no hairs at all, have had more perhaps sales and marketing experience, even though in a different distant past we developed things. So the way we started CSR is we had three founding directors, with me as managing director, another guy as technical director, and another as marketing director, and the other six were founding engineers, and we defined the roles quite clearly in that way. And when we came to the VCs, we said, look, here we are, we're lacking certain skills, we know not as much about manufacturing chips as we should, and we don't know as much about finance as we should, although we'd all run spreadsheets and dabbled at being financiers. So it just happened in a way, and it seemed that was the best group to start the company, because we were taking a fair amount of intellectual property from Cambridge Consultants, and the lawyer's advice, Nilsson Reeves' advice, who we used, was to have a sale and purchase agreement, and so formally for that sale and purchase agreement, where we all signed it, where they gave us certain things like the permission to spin out. They gave us some intellectual property and they licensed other intellectual property to us. And in return, we gave them some equity in the company. And it just seemed that that was the right grouping, and indeed it was to a certain extent the project team that we spun out to do CSR.
First question on controlling costs. I think maybe this is a general point that you should think about when using lawyers, or indeed using any professional services, is you should treat your lawyers in exactly the way you treat your plumbers. You wouldn't have a plumber come in, fix your radiator and then send you the bill afterwards. You'd always ask for a quote. And all lawyers should give you an estimate before they start the work. It may only be a staged estimate, writing the first round of correspondence and drafting the first version of the agreement. But you know, it should not be in an open-ended checkbook that you're handing your lawyer. So it's, you know, it's a two-way process. You know, for example, you could say to them, okay, you've quoted me X, but at the moment I only want to spend Y. So if you're getting up towards Y, then can you let me know? Because then I need to reassess whether or not I want to take it further. So as I say, it's, you know, you can control costs. Obviously, yeah, at the end of the day, some lawyers are more expensive than others, and you know, you get what you pay for, and it, you know, it's a service like anything. So that's, I hope, helped with the first thing. Always ask. Don't be afraid to ask. If a lawyer won't tell you how much they charge per hour, then or how much the job is likely to cost, then yeah, go and ask someone else.
And particularly around here, where there's a lot of experience, lawyers helping small companies, lawyers will often hesitate to say as a lost leader, where they are interested in getting involved with a company that they think has a future, will be very cost effective in what they charge on the basis of as that company increases its size, they will earn more fees later on. Yeah. And around Cambridge is a great place to do lawyering because there are a good number of them, and I guess there's competition as well, which helps
keep
the price
down. That's a very good point.
I think the thing is there are standard agreements when you're getting together to form a company like Isabel's mentioned, service agreements, directors and employment agreements for staff and indeed investment agreements. If you think that you need very much more to control the actions of some of your co-workers or co-founders, I think you want to think about whether you actually get on well with those people. And because you'll be living very closely with them for the next 5 to 10 years, you know, do you really want to do that? No, that's one of the advantages of having 9 people. The 6 engineers primarily took the word, a couple of us directors, co-founders, who indeed spent a good proportion of our time reading the agreements and making sure we understood them and taking legal advice and even, you know, second opinions. And because we were on exactly the same wavelength as our co-founders, you know, we're all pointed at the same sort of goal in the future, you know, they took our word for it and it, were able to get on and do the engineering. So that's how it works.
I think it could well be a factor. At the moment, we're in a slightly difficult position because those duties aren't going to come into force, I think, until early 2008. And the government is going to provide, publish more guidance on what is actually meant by that, apparently in July this year. So that might help us. But I think that's a very good point. If you had a director who clearly was incompetent in certain of those areas, then it is going to be very difficult to show that he had, you know, that he was promoting the success of the business.
And one of the things we'll be looking to people like Milton Reeve to advise on. You know, if there's a 2 metres of documents, okay, but what are the important ones and what do we need to take account of? You certainly don't want to be reading 2 metres of document yourself. And the answer, I think, is, you know, quite a lot of it probably is not relevant. But only time will tell, I guess, with case precedent. The question is, you know, do we actually need that? Is anything broke? Why do we need 2 metres of the new Companies Act? I don't know.
That's Enron. The shadow of Enron.
That's why they're all coming over here, isn't it?
And again, it's another sort of issue that came out of the whole sort of corporate collapse scandal of Enron. The way that we've interpreted it in the UK is to ensure that companies have non-executive directors on their boards who can sort of, if you like, keep a controlling eye on.
Yeah, from an early stage at CSR we had non-execs and you should add people who can add value to the business, and know something about your business, or understand how a company should present itself in the city. And those are the key things. And of course, as companies become public, there are all sorts of Cadbury and Greenbury guidelines as to how boards should be constituted. But it isn't something that you should get overly concerned about, in my view.
Never take being a director lightly. You know, if your mate says, I'll give you a couple of shares and I'll put you down on the form as a director, is that okay? Because we need to have a couple of directors down the company, or the list of companies house. I mean, fine, but make sure it's very clear what your responsibilities are and ask for an indemnity, i.e. protection from the company. If anything goes wrong, they will cover your costs. Directors and officers insurance is a form of sort of like professional indemnity insurance for those directors which insist that the company pays for.
Something
like
that.
You're right, that's generally speaking the current position. In the US, it's almost a complete opposite, that the business concepts and software is very easily protectable by patents. There's been a lot of debate in Europe about sort of going down the US route, but a lot of people have argued the contrary, that it's just not appropriate form of protection for software. But I think it's something that's coming our way. Already there's a grey area. So to say that software can't be patented in the UK is a very sort of black and white statement. It's fuzzy already around the edges. So I wouldn't be surprised if it happens in the next 10 years or so.
And am I right in thinking that other things are important too, the software life, copywriting,
yeah,
and trademarking, so that if you have created a buzz with your Super X software tool, for example, you can protect that in such a way so that even though somebody may be able to copy perhaps a fair bit of the software, they can't copy Super X or indeed the copyrighted part of that.
It's a good idea to get them to help you out, but it's important that they sign up. There can be, obviously as a lawyer I'd like to sign up a much longer document, but it can be a relative straightforward, even by letter, saying you're paying me X, and in return for your payment, I will assign all my rights in the work that I do for you to you or to your company. But you must have a clear agreement, because otherwise they will own those rights. I mean, it's without a doubt. You should still get them to sign a piece of paper. In fact, in a way, it's more important if they're doing it for nothing, because the way the courts operate, the difficulty is that when I was talking earlier, I was being very generalistic and simplistic, but what the courts will say is, if you've paid me, let's say, £5,000 to help you out with some software development, then okay, I own the IP in that module. But if we went to court to argue, the courts would probably say, well, okay, Isabel, you own the IP in that module, but that chap has paid you £5,000. So he's always got some rights in it. And probably what the courts would say is, you have got the rights to use that module in your software package. But what the courts would probably go on to say is, well, at the time, it was only contemplated that you'd be using that in your software package for your own internal business use. You wouldn't be selling that package to other people. the whole limits of what your rights are and what my rights are would be fuzzy. But as I say, that's only in the situation where you pay me money. So if you haven't paid me any money at all, then courts would say, well, sorry, why should she give you that IP? So it's, as I say, it's even more important. You must get it agreed before the work starts, basically.
Just a simple agreement.
Yeah. I wouldn't recommend this, but even if it was an exchange of emails that made it clear that your intention and their intention was that everything that came out of that relationship was owned by you, then that would be sufficient evidence. In an ideal world, you'd be looking for, manufacturing agreement or whether the particular outsourcing was a consultancy agreement. The more evidence that you've got that that's what the parties agreed, then in the better position you'd be in. Because otherwise, you don't want to get in the position of, 5 years later saying, well, actually, I quite like that IP now. Can I have it, please? PCT, Patent Cooperation Treaty, is a money-saving mechanism, if you like. Instead of having to go to every single country in the world and apply for a patent, you start off your patent application in, say, the US or the UK or Europe, and then you have a certain period of time whilst you develop your invention, whilst you develop the product, whatever it is. And after that period of time, you can then decide whether you want to expand it into the countries of the PCT. So it's a breathing space before deciding whether or not to lash out on spending patent fees in a large number of companies. So it's a very good device and one that's used frequently by companies. You've got to bite the bullet. Going the PCT route at least enables you to defer the fees for as long as you reasonably can. But there isn't a way to save money. I mean, it's one of the really problematic sides of patenting, that it is expensive. I mean, the only way to do it is to try and get investment at an earlier stage. But that's easier said than done, really. I'm afraid there's no magic wand there.
What you have to remember, of course, is that there are different venture capitalists and corporate investors. A venture capitalist is primarily concerned with the use of capital, the best use of capital to invest in your company in order to increase the size of that capital. A corporate investor is interested in investing in your company. Quite often, it's a side objective to make money. I mean, nobody wants to lose it. So Intel, for example, and Sony and Philips and Siemens and others invested in CSR as corporate investors. But our objective and their objective was to work with them in order to develop technology that could be used in their products. And we didn't do special projects. We were developing Bluetooth chips, standard chips that we would sell to everybody. So in fact, one of the intellectual property agreements we had with one of those corporates was perhaps one of the biggest documents that we developed. And that was to say, well, look, who owns the intellectual property as we go along? Bear in mind that CSR, when it develops its chips, is going to sell those on the open market. What it would be prepared to do is to allow that and other corporate investors a little lead time with those chips to get their products out to market first. So their objectives are different, and mainly you'll end up working with the product developers and the people perhaps in the research labs rather than the financiers. But they're very complementary. So I would say that corporate investors are actually just as important as VCs, but they're different.
I've not got very much to add on what Phil said, other than the fact that the whole problem with VCs is this concept of looking for potentially an early exit. In both cases, what I would say is it's very worth taking advice before you sign the heads of terms one of the problems that we frequently see is that we will sign heads of terms, the outline bullet points of the deal. They sign them because they're not binding, they're not really binding. They think, oh wow, then it goes down the line, we can always change our mind. But although they're not legally binding, it's very difficult to negotiate away from that position.
That's a very, very important point. The VCs will say, perhaps this is a light and easy document, it's only 2 pages. There are 20 bullets in it which will define the way that we will develop our investment agreement with you. But as soon as you sign something like that, even though it might not be legally binding, you start to go down a certain path. So that actually is the stage when you should get legal input at that very, very beginning, rather than wait until you have to develop a more weighty investment agreement. Yeah.